He stopped pacing and jabbed his finger at my face.
And I thought you was different. What was you doing when Benton wasn't looking? That's what I want to know. And all this time I'm feeling sorry for you.
Get out of my room now. My self-control snapped.
You goddamn jealous son of a bitch. How dare you even allude to my relationship with Benton? What do you know?
Nothing, Marino.
He's dead, Marino. He's been dead for over a year, Marino. And I'm not dead, and you're not dead. Or right now I wish you was.
You sound like Lucy when she was 10. He stalked out and slammed the door so hard, paintings shifted on the wall, and the chandelier shook. I picked up the phone and called the front desk.
"Is there a Jay Talley in the lobby?" I asked.
"Tall, dark, young, wearing a beige leather jacket, jeans."
"Yes, I see him, madame."
Seconds later, Talley was on the phone.
"Marino just stormed out of here," I said.
"Don't let him see you, Jay. He's crazy."
"Actually, he's just getting off the elevator now. And you're right. He looks a little crazy. Gotta go."
I ran out of my room. I ran as fast as I could through the corridor and down the winding, carpeted steps, ignoring the odd stares I got from well-dressed, civilized people who walked at a leisurely pace and didn't get into fistfights in the Grand Hotel in Paris. I slowed down when I reached the lobby, lungs burning and out of breath, and to my horror watched Marino taking swings at Talley while two bellmen and a valet tried to intervene. A man at the registration desk frantically dialed the phone, probably calling the police.
"Marino, no!" I said loudly and with authority as I hurried over to him. "Marino, no!"
I grabbed his arm. He was glassy-eyed and sweating profusely, and thank God he had no gun because I was afraid he might have used it just then. I kept hold of his arm while Talley talked in French and gestured, assuring everyone there was no problem and not to call the police. I led Marino by the hand through the lobby like a mother about to discipline a very bad little boy. I escorted him past valets and expensive cars and out onto the sidewalk where I stopped.
"Do you have any idea what you're doing?" I asked him.
He wiped his face on the back of his hand. He was breathing so hard he was wheezing. It occurred to me he might have a heart attack.
"Marino," I shook his arm, "listen to me. What you just did in there is unconscionable. Talley has done nothing to you. I've done nothing to you."
"Maybe I'm sticking up for Benton because he ain't here to do it himself," Marino said in a flat, worn-out voice.
"No, you were throwing punches at Carrie Greffin, at Joyce. It's them you want to beat up, maim, kill."
He took deep, defeated breaths.
"Don't you think I know what you're doing?" I went on in an intense, quiet voice.
People were shadows drifting past us on the sidewalk. Lights spilled out of brasseries and cafes that were having busy nights, their small outdoor tables full.
"You have to take it out on someone," I went on. "That's the way it works. And who is there to go after? Carrie and Joyce are dead."
"At least you and Lucy got to kill the motherfuckers. Shoot their goddamn asses out of the air,"
Marino began to sob.
"Come on," I said.
I took his arm in mine and we started walking.
"I had nothing to do with killing them," I said.
"Not that I would have hesitated, Marino. But Lucy pulled the trigger. And you know what? She doesn't feel the better for it. She still hates and simmers and beats and shoots her way through life. She'll have her day of reckoning, too. And this is yours. Let it go."
"Why did you have to go and do that with him?" he asked in a small, pained voice as he wiped his eyes on his sleeve. "How come, Doc? Why him?"
"There's no one good enough for me, is that it?" I said. He had to think about that.
"And there's no one good enough for you. No one as good as Doris. When she divorced you, that was hard, wasn't it? And I've never thought any woman you've been with since is even close to what she was. But we have to try, Marino. We have to live."
"Yeah, and they all dumped me, too, those women who ain't good enough for me."
"They dumped you because they're bowling alley bimbos." He smiled in the dark.
37. The streets of Paris were waking up and getting lively as Talley and I walked to the Café Reims.
The air was cool and felt good on my face, but I was anxious and full of doubt again. I wished I'd never come to France. When we crossed the Place de l'Opéra and he reached for my hand, I wished I had never met Jay Talley. His fingers were warm and strong and slender, and I never expected that such a gentle form of affection would jolt and revulse me when what we'd done in my room hours earlier had not. I felt ashamed of myself.
"I want you to know this matters to me," he said. "I don't have flings, Kay. I'm not into one-night stands. It's important you know that."
"Don't fall in love with me, Jay," I looked up at him. His silence said everything about how those words made him feel. "Jay, I'm not saying I don't care.
You'll really like this cafe," he said. "It's a secret. You'll see. No one in here speaks anything but French, and if you don't speak French, you have to point on the menu or get out your little dictionary, and the owner will be amused by you. Odette is very no-nonsense, but very nice."
I was scarcely hearing a word.
"She and I have a détente. If she's pleasant, I patronize her establishment. If I'm pleasant, she lets me patronize her establishment."
"I want you to listen to me," I said, slipping my hand up his arm and leaning against it. "The last thing I ever want to do is hurt anyone. I didn't want to hurt you, and I already have."
"How could I feel hurt? This afternoon was incredible."
"Yes, it was," I said. "But..." He stopped on the sidewalk and looked into my eyes as people flowed around us and light from shops unevenly shoved back the night. I was raw and alive where he had touched me.
"I didn't ask you to love me," he said.
"That's not something you should have to ask." We started walking again.
"I know it's not something you freely offer, Kay," he said. "Love is your loup-garou, the monster you fear, and I can see why. It's tracked you down and hurt you all your life.
Don't try to psychoanalyze me. Don't try to change me, Jay." People bumped us as they jostled past. Several teenagers with body piercing and dyed hair bumped into us and laughed. A small crowd was staring and pointing at an almost life-size yellow biplane attached to the side of the Grand Marnier building, advertised a Breitling watch show. Roasting chestnuts smelled burnt.
"I've not touched anyone since Benton died," I said.
"That's where you are in my food chain, Jay."
I wasn't trying to be cruel.
"I'll fly home in the morning."
"I wish you wouldn't."
"I have a mission, remember?" I said. Anger slipped out of hiding, and when Tally tried to hold my hand again, I slipped my fingers away from him. "Or should I say I'll sneak home in the morning," I said, "with a briefcase of illegal evidence that's also, by the way, a biological hazard. I'll follow my orders, trooper that I am, and get DNA from the swabs, if possible. Compare it to the unidentified body's DNA. Eventually determine that he and the killer are brothers. Meanwhile, maybe the cops will luck out and find a werewolf wandering the streets, and he'll tell you guys everything about the Chandon cartel. And maybe only two or three other women will be savaged before all this happens."
"Please don't be so bitter," Jay said.
"Bitter? I shouldn't be bitter." We turned off the Boulevard des Italiens onto the Rue Favart. "I shouldn't be bitter when I was sent here to solve problems, when I've been a pawn in some scheme I knew nothing about."
"I'm sorry you look at it that way," he said.
"We're bad for each other," I said. Café Runtz was small and quiet, with green-checked cloths and green glassware. Red lamps glowed and the chandelier was red. Odette was making a drink at the bar when we walked in. Her way of greeting Tally was to throw her hands up in despair and chastise him. "She's accusing me of staying away 2 months and then not calling before I come in," he translated for me. He leaned over the bar and kissed her on both cheeks to make amends. Regardless of how crowded the cafe was, she managed to fit us into a choice corner table because Tally had that effect on people. He was used to getting what he wanted. He picked out a Centenay red burgundy, since he remembered I'd told him how much I liked burgundies, although I didn't recall when I'd said that or if I really had. By now I wasn't sure what he already knew and what he'd gotten directly from me. "Let's see," he said, scanning the menu. "I highly recommend the Alsacienne specialties, but to start, the salade de gruyere, shaved gruyere that looks like pasta on lettuce and tomato. It's filling, though.
Maybe that's all I'll get, then, I said, with no appetite.
He reached inside his jacket pocket and pulled out a small cigar and clipper.
Helps me cut back on cigarettes, he explained. Would you like one?
Everybody in France smokes too much. It's time I quit again, I said.
They're very good. He snipped off the tip. Dipped in sugar. This one's vanilla, but I also have cinnamon and sambuca. He fired a match. But I like the vanilla best. He puffed.
You really should taste this.
He offered it to me.
No, thank you, I said.
I order them from a wholesaler in Miami, he went on, flourishing his cigar and throwing his head back to blow out smoke. Cohimars. Not to be confused with Cohibas, which are wonderful, but illegal if they're Cuban versus those made in the Dominican Republic. Illegal in the U.S., at any rate. And I know that because I'm ATF. Yes, ma'am, I know my alcohol, tobacco, and firearms.
He'd already finished his first glass of wine.
The three R's, running, running, and running. Ever heard that? They teach it in the School of Hard Knocks.
He refilled his glass and topped off mine.
If I came back to the States, would you see me again? For the sake of argument, what would happen if I transferred, let's say, back to Washington?
I didn't mean to do this to you, I said. Tears touched his eyes, and he quickly looked away.
I never meant to. It's my fault, I softly said.
Fault, he said.
Fault? I didn't realize there was fault involved, as in something to be blamed, as in a mistake.
He leaned into the table and smiled smugly, as if he were a detective who just tripped me with a trick question.
Fault? He pondered, blowing smoke.
Jay, you're so young, I said.
Someday you'll understand.
I can't help my age, he interrupted me, in a voice that caused glances.
And you live in France, for God's sake. There are worse places to live.
You can dance around words all you want, Jay, I said, but reality always has its way with people.
You're sorry, aren't you?
He leaned back.
I know so much about you, and then I go do something as stupid as that.
I never said it was stupid.
It's because you aren't ready.
I was getting upset, too.
You can't possibly know if I'm ready or not ready, I told him, as the waiter appeared to take our order and then discreetly moved on.
You spend far too much time in my mind and maybe not enough in your own.
Okay. Don't worry. I won't ever try to anticipate your feelings or thoughts again.
Ah, petulance, I replied. At last you're acting your age.
His eyes flashed. I sipped my wine. He'd already finished another glass.
I deserve respect, too, he said. I'm not a child.
What was this afternoon, Kay? Social work? Charity? Sex education? Foster care?
Maybe we shouldn't talk about this here, I suggested.
Or maybe you just used me, he went on.
I'm too old for you. Please lower your voice.
Old is my mother, my aunt. The deaf widow who lives next door to me is old.
I realized I had no idea where Tally lived. I didn't even have his home telephone number.
Old is the way you act when you're overbearing and condescending and a chicken, he said, raising his glass to me.
A chicken? I've been called a lot of things, but never a chicken.
You're an emotional chicken.
He drank as if trying to put out a fire.
That's why you were with him. He was safe.
I don't care how much you say you loved him. He was safe.
Don't talk about something you know nothing about, I warned him as I began to tremble.
Because you're afraid. You've been afraid ever since your father died. Ever since you felt different from everyone, because you are different from everyone, and that's the price people like us pay. We're special. We're alone, and we rarely think it's because we're special. We just think there's something wrong with us.
I placed my napkin on top of the table and pushed back my chair.
That's the problem with you intelligence-gathering assholes, I said in a low, calm voice. You appropriate the secrets, the treasures and tragedies and ecstasies of someone as if they are your own. At least I have a life. At least I don't live voyeuristically through people I don't know. At least I'm not some kind of spy.
I'm not a spy, he said. It was my job to find out as much as I could about you, he said.
"And you did your job extraordinarily well," I said, stung, "especially this afternoon."
"Please don't leave," he quietly said, as he reached across the table for my hand.
I pulled away from him. I walked out of the restaurant as other diners stared. Someone laughed and made a comment I didn't need to translate to understand. It was obvious that the handsome young man and his older lady friend were having a lover's spat. Or maybe he was her gigolo. It was almost 9:30, and I walked with determination toward the hotel, while everyone else in the city, it seemed, continued to venture out. A woman police officer wearing white gloves whistled traffic through as I waited with a great crowd to cross the Boulevard des Capucines. The air was bright with voices and cold light from the moon. The aromas of crepe and beignet and chestnuts roasting in small grills made me heartsick and dizzy. I hurried like a fugitive evading apprehension, and yet I lingered at street corners because I wanted to be caught. Tally did not come after me. When I reached my hotel, breathless and upset, I couldn't bear the thought of seeing Marina or returning to my room. I got a taxi because I had one more thing to do. I would do it alone and at night, because I felt reckless and desperate. "Yes," the driver said, turning around to look at me. "Madame?" I felt pieces of me had been rearranged, and I didn't know where to put them because I couldn't remember where they'd been before. "Do you speak English?" I asked. "Yes." "Do you know much about the city? Could you tell me about what I'm seeing?"
"Seeing, you mean now?"
"Seeing as we drive," I said.
"Am I tour guide?"
He thought I was very funny.
"No, but I live here. Where would you like to go?"
"Do you know where the morgue is? On the Seine, near the Gare de Lyon?"
"You want to go there?"
He turned around again and frowned at me as he waited to insert himself in traffic. "I will want to go there. But first I want to go to the Ile Saint-Louis," I said, scanning, looking for Tally as hope got dark like the street.
"What?"
My driver laughed as if I were the premier crazy.
"You want to go to the morgue and Ile Saint-Louis? What connection is that? Someone rich die?"
I was getting annoyed with him. "Please," I said, "let's go."
"Okay, sure, if that's what you want."
Tires over cobblestones sounded like kettle drums, and lamplight flashing off the Seine looked like schools of silver fish. I rubbed fog off my window and opened it enough so I could see better as we crossed the Pont Louis-Philippe and entered the island. I instantly recognized the 17th-century homes that once had been the private hotels of the noblesse. I had been here before, with Benton. We had walked these narrow cobblestone streets and browsed the historic plaques on some of the walls that told who once had lived here. We had stopped in outdoor cafes and across the way bought ice cream at Bertillon. I told my driver to circle the island. It was solid, with gorgeous homes of limestone pitted by the years, and balconies were black wrought iron. Windows were lit up, and through them were glimpses of exposed beams, bookcases and fine paintings, but I saw no one. It was as if the elitist people who lived here were invisible to the rest of us. "Have you ever heard of the Chandon family?" I asked my driver.
"But of course," he said. "Would you like to see where they live?"
"Please," I said, with great misgivings. He drove to the Quai d'Orléans, past the residence where Pompidou died on the second floor, the blinds still drawn, and onto the Quai de Béthune, toward the eastern tip of the island. I dug in my satchel and got out a bottle of Advil. The taxi stopped. I sensed my driver didn't care to get any closer to the Chandon home.
"Turn the corner there," he pointed, "and walk to Quai d'Anjou. You will see doors carved with chamois. That is the Chandon crest, I guess you would call it. Even the drain pipes are chamois. It is really something. You can't miss it. And stay away from the bridge over there on the right bank," he said. "Underneath it, that is where the homeless and homosexuals are. It is dangerous."
The Hôtel Particulier, where the Chandon family had lived for hundreds of years, was a four-story townhouse with multiple dormer windows, chimneys, and an œil de bœuf, or beef's eye, which was a round window at the roof. The front doors were dark wood, ornately covered with chamois, and fleet-footed goats held on tooth and nail to form gilded drainpipes. The hair pricked up on my flesh. I tucked myself in shadows and stared across the street at the lair that had spawned this monster who called himself the Loup-Garou. Through windows, chandeliers sparkled and bookcases were crowded with hundreds of books. I was startled when a woman suddenly appeared in the glass. She was enormously fat. She wore a dark red robe with deep sleeves, the material rich like satin or silk. I stared, transfixed. Her face was impatient, her lips moving fast as she talked to someone, and almost instantly a maid appeared with a small silver tray bearing a liqueur glass. Madame Chandon, if that's who the woman was, sipped her drink. She lit a cigarette with a silver lighter and walked out of view. I walked fast to the tip of the island, less than a block away, and from a small park there I could barely make out the silhouette of the morgue. I guessed it was but several miles upriver on the other side of the Pont Sully. I scanned the Seine and fantasized that the killer was the son of the obese woman I just saw, that for years he had bathed nude here without her knowing, moonlight shining on his long, pale hair. I imagined him emerging from his noble home and wandering to this park after dark to dip into what he hoped would heal him. How many years had he waded in that frigid, dirty water? I wondered if he ranged about the right bank, where he watched people who were as estranged from society as he was. Maybe he even mingled with them. Stairs led down from the street to the quay, and the river was so high it lapped over cobblestone in murky ruffles that smelled faintly of sewage. The Seine was swollen from unrelenting rain, the current very strong, and an occasional duck flowed past, even though ducks weren't supposed to swim at night. Iron gas lamps glowed and dashed flakes of gold in patterns over the water. I took the cap off the bottle of Advil and poured the pills on the ground. I carefully ventured down slick stone stairs to the quay. Water lapped around my feet as I swished the plastic bottle clean and filled it with frigid water. I snapped the cap back on and returned to the taxi, glancing back several times at the Chandon home, halfway expecting cartel criminals to suddenly spring out after me. "Take me to the morgue, please," I said to my driver. It was dark, and razor wire, not noticeable during the day, reflected light from cars speeding past. "Pull into the back parking lot," I said. He turned off the Quai de la Rapée into the small area behind the building where vans had been parked and the sad couple had waited on a bench earlier in the day. I got out. "Stay right here," I said to my driver. "I'm just going to walk around for a minute." His face was wan, and when I got a better look at him, I realized he was very wrinkled and missing several teeth. He looked uneasy, his eyes darting about as if maybe he were thinking about speeding away. "It's all right," I said to him as I got a notebook out of my satchel. "Oh, you're a journalist," he said with relief. "You're here working on a story." "Yes, a story." He grinned, hanging halfway out his open window. "You had me worried, madame. I thought maybe you were some sort of ghoul." "Give me just a minute," I said. I wandered around, feeling the damp cold of old stone and air blowing off the river as I moved around in the darkness of deep shadows and took interest in every detail, as if I were he. He would have been fascinated by this place. It was the Hall of Dishonor that displayed his trophies after his kills and reminded him of his sovereign immunity. He could do whatever he wanted, whenever he pleased, and leave all the evidence in the world and he wouldn't be touched. He probably could have walked from his house to the morgue in 20 or 30 minutes, and I envisioned him sitting in the park, staring at the old brick building and imagining what was going on inside, what work he had created for Dr. Estefan. I wondered if the odor of death excited him. A faint breeze stirred acacia trees and touched my skin as I replayed what Dr. Estefan had said about the man who had come to her door. He had come to murder her and had failed. He returned to this very spot and left her a note the next day. "Par la police." Perhaps we were trying to make his modus operandi far too complicated. "Pas de problème. Le loup-garou." Perhaps it was as simple as a raging, murderous lust he could not control. Once the monster in him was aroused by someone, there was no escape. I was certain if he were still in France, Dr. Estevan would be dead. Perhaps when he fled to Richmond, he thought he could control himself for a while. And maybe he did for 3 days. Or maybe he had been watching Kim Luong the entire time, fantasizing until he couldn't resist the evil impulse any longer. I hurried back to my taxi, and the windows were so fogged up I could not see through them as I pulled open the back door. Inside, the heater was blasting, my driver half asleep. He sat up with a start and swore. 38. Concorde Flight 2 left Charles de Gaulle Airport at 11 and arrived in New York at 8:45 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, which was before we'd left, in a sense. I walked into my house mid-afternoon, terribly out of sorts, my body confused about time, my emotions screaming. The weather was getting bad, with predictions of freezing rain and sleet again, and I had errands to run. Marino went home. He had that big truck, after all. Ucrop's grocery store was mobbed because whenever sleet or snow was predicted, Richmonders lost their minds. They envisioned starving to death or having nothing to drink, and by the time I got to the bread section, there wasn't a single loaf left. There was no turkey or ham in the deli. I bought whatever I could because I expected Lucy to stay with me for a while. I headed home a little past 6 and didn't have the energy to negotiate a peace settlement with my garage, so I parked my car out front. Wispy white clouds over the moon looked exactly like a skull, then shifted and were formless, rushing on as the wind blew harder, trees shivering and whispering. I felt achy and woozy as if I might be getting sick, and I got increasingly worried when once again Lucy didn't call or come home. I assumed she was at MCV, but when I contacted the orthopedic unit, I was told she hadn't been there since yesterday morning. I began to get frantic. I paced the great room and thought hard. It was almost 10 o'clock when I got back in my car and drove toward downtown, tension stringing me so tight I thought I might snap. I knew it was possible Lucy had gone on to D.C., but I couldn't imagine her doing that without at least leaving me a note. Whenever she disappeared without a word, it never meant anything good. I turned off on the 9th Street exit and drove through downtown's vacant streets and wandered through several levels of the hospital's parking deck before I found a space. I grabbed a lab coat off the back seat of my car. The orthopedic unit was in the new hospital on the 2nd floor, and when I got to the room, I slipped my lab coat on and opened the door. A couple I assumed were Joe's parents were inside, sitting by the bed, and I walked over to them. Joe's head was bandaged, her leg in traction, but she was awake, and her eyes immediately fixed on me. "Mr. and Mrs. Sanders," I said. "I'm Dr. Scarpetta." If my name meant anything to them, they didn't acknowledge it, but Mr. Sanders politely stood and shook my hand. "Nice to meet you," he said. He wasn't at all what I'd envisioned. I supposed after Joe's description of her parents' rigid attitudes, I expected stern faces and eyes that judged everything they saw. But Mr. and Mrs. Sanders were overweight and frumpy, not formidable-looking in the least. They were very polite, even shy, as I asked them about their daughter. Joe continued to stare at me, a look in her eyes that called out to me to help. "Would you mind if I speak to the patient in private for a moment?" I asked them. "That would be fine," Mrs. Sanders says. "Now, Joe, you do what the doctor says," Mr. Sanders told his daughter in a dispirited way. They went out, and the instant I shut the door, Joe's eyes filled with tears. I bent over and kissed her cheek. "You've had all of us worried sick," I said. "How's Lucy?" she whispered, as sobs began to shake her and tears flowed. I placed tissues in a hand that was tethered by IV tubes. "I don't know. I don't know where she is, Joe. Your parents told her you didn't want to see her, and..." Joe started shaking her head. "I knew they'd do that," she said in a dark, depressed tone. "I knew they would. They told me she didn't want to see me. She was too upset because of what happened. I didn't believe them. I know she would never do something like that. But they ran her off, and now she's gone. And maybe she believes what they said." "She feels what happened to you is her fault," I said. "It's very possible the bullet in your leg came from her gun. Please bring her to me. Please." "Do you have any idea where she might be?" I asked. Is there any place she might go when she's upset like this? Maybe back to Miami? I'm sure she wouldn't go there. I sat down in a chair by the bed and blew out a long, exhausted breath. A hotel, maybe? I asked a friend. Maybe New York, Joe said. There's a bar in Greenwich Village. Ruby Fruit. You think she went to New York? I asked, dismayed. The owner's name is Anne, a former cop. Her voice shook. Oh, I don't know, I don't know. She scares me when she runs away. She doesn't think right when she gets like that. I know. And with all that's gone on, she can't be thinking right anyway. Joe, you should be getting out of here in another day or so if you behave, I said with a smile. Where do you want to go? I don't want to go home. You'll find her, won't you? Would you like to stay with me? I asked. My parents aren't bad people, she muttered as morphine dripped. They don't understand. They think... Why is it wrong? It's not, I said. Love is never wrong. I left the room as she drifted. Her parents were outside the door. Both looked exhausted and sad. How is she? Mr. Sanders said. Not too well, I said. Mrs. Sanders began to cry. You have a right to believe the way you do, I said. But preventing Lucy and Joe from seeing each other is the last thing your daughter needs right now. She doesn't need more fear and depression. She doesn't need to lose her will to live, Mr. and Mrs. Sanders. Neither of them replied. I'm Lucy's aunt, I said. She's about back in this world anyways, I guess, Mr. Sanders said. Can't keep anybody from her. We were just trying to do what's best. Joan knows that, I replied. She loves you. They didn't say goodbye, but watched me as I got on the elevator. I called Ruby Fruit the minute I got home and asked for Anne over the loud noise of voices and a band. She's not in great shape, Anne said to me, and I knew what that meant. Will you take care of her? I asked. I already am, she said. Hold on, let me get her. I saw Joe, I said, when Lucy got on the phone. Oh, was all she said, and it was obvious from one word that she was drunk. Lucy! I don't want to talk right now, she said. Joe loves you, I said. Come home. Then what do I do? We bring her to my house from the hospital and you take care of her, I said. That's what you do. I barely slept. At 2 a.m. I finally got up and went into the kitchen to fix a cup of herbal tea. It was still raining hard, water running off the roof and splashing on the patio, and I couldn't seem to get warm. I thought about the swabs and hair and photographs of bite marks locked inside my briefcase, and it almost seemed the killer was inside my house. I could feel his presence, as if those parts of him emanated evil. I thought about the awful irony. Interpol summoned me to France, and after all was said and done, the only legal evidence I had was an Advil bottle filled with water and silt from the Seine. When it got to be 3 a.m., I sat up in bed writing draft after draft of a letter to Tally. Nothing sounded right. I was frightened by how much I missed him and what I had done to him. Now he was striking back, and it was exactly what I deserved. I crumpled another sheet of stationery and looked at the phone. I calculated what time it was in Lyon and imagined him at his desk in one of his fine suits. I thought of him on the phone and in meetings or maybe escorting someone else around and not giving me a thought. I thought of his hard, smooth body, and I wondered where he had learned to be such a lover. I went on to work. When it was almost 2 p.m. in France, I decided to call Interpol. Bonjour, hello. J. Tally, please, I said. I was transferred. Hidta, a man answered. I paused, confused. Is this J. Tally's extension? Who is this? I told him. He's not here, the man said. Fear shot through me. I didn't believe him. And to whom am I speaking? I inquired. Agent Wilson. I'm the FBI liaison. We didn't meet the other day. Jay's out. Do you know when he'll be back? I'm not really sure. I see, I said. Is it possible for me to reach him? Or can you ask him to call me? I knew I sounded nervous. "I really don't know where he is," he replied. "But if he checks in, I'll let him know you called. Is there something I can help you with?"
"No," I said. I hung up and felt panicky. I was certain Tally didn't want any contact with me and had instructed people that if I called, he wasn't there. "Oh, God, oh, God," I whispered as I walked past Rose's desk. "What have I done?"
"Are you talking to me?" She looked up from her keyboard, peering at me over her glasses. "Did you lose something again?"
"Yes," I said.
At 8:30, I walked into staff meeting and took my usual place at the head of the table. "What have we got?" I asked. "Black female, 32 years old, from Albemarle County," Chong began. "Ran off the road and flipped her car. Apparently she just veered off the road and lost control. She has a fracture of the right leg, a basilar skull fracture, and the ME for Albemarle County, Dr. Richards, wants us to do a post." He looked up at me. "I'm just wondering why. Her cause and manner seem pretty clear." "Because the code says we supply services to the local ME," I replied. "They ask, we do it. We can take an hour to post her now, or we can take 10 hours later on to sort it out if there's a problem." "Next is an 80-year-old white female last seen yesterday morning around 9 a.m. Her boyfriend found her last night at 6:30. I had to work very hard not to tune in and out. "No known drug abuse or foul play," Chong droned on. "Nitroglycerin present at scene." Tally made love as if he were starving. I couldn't believe I was having erotic thoughts in the middle of staff meeting.
"She needs a look-see for injury and toxicology," Fielding was saying. "Needs a view."
"Anybody know what I'm teaching at the Institute next week?" toxicologist Tim Cooper asked.
"Toxicology, probably."
"Really?" Cooper sighed. "I need a secretary."
"I've got 3 court appearances today," Assistant Chief Riley was saying, "which is impossible since they're all over the place."
The door opened and Rose stuck her head inside and motioned to me to come out into the hall.
"Larry Posner's got to leave in a little while," she said, "and he's wondering if you could stop by his lab right now."
"On my way," I said. When I walked in, he was making a permanent slide, using a pipette to touch a drop of Cargill melt mount on the edge of a cover slip while other slides warmed up on a hot plate.
"I don't know if it adds up to much," he said right off. "Take a look in the scope. Diatoms from your un-ID'd guy. Keep in mind the only thing an individual diatom will tell you, with rare exception, is if it's saltwater, brackish, or fresh."
I peered into the lens at little organisms that looked as if they were made of clear glass, in all sorts of shapes that brought to mind boats, chains, and zigzags, and slivered moons, and tiger stripes, and crosses, and even stacks of poker chips. There were pieces and parts that reminded me of confetti and grains of sand and other particles of different colors that probably were minerals. Posner removed the slide from the stage and replaced it with another.
"The sample you brought back from the Sen," he said. "Cymbella, Melocyra, Navicula, Fragilaria, on and on, common as dust, all freshwater, so at least that's good, but they really tell us nothing in and of themselves."
I leaned back in the chair and looked at him.
"You ordered me here to tell me that?" I said, disappointed.
"Well, I'm no Robert McLaughlin," he dryly said, referring to the world-renowned diatomist who had trained him.
He leaned over the microscope and adjusted the magnification to 1,000x and began moving slides around.
"And no, I didn't ask you to drop by for nothing," he went on. "Where we lucked out is in the frequency of occurrence of each species in the flora."
Flora was a botanical listing of plants by species, or in this case, diatoms by species.
51% occurrence of Melocyra, 15% occurrence of Fragilaria. I won't bore you with all of it, but the samples are very consistent with each other. So much so, actually, I would almost call them identical, which I find rather miraculous, since the flora where you dipped in your Advil bottle might be totally different 100 feet away.
It chilled me to think of Ile Saint-Louis' shore, of the stories of the nude man swimming after dark so close to the Chandon house. I imagined him dressing without showering or drying off, and transferring diatoms to the inside of his clothes.
"If he swims in the Seine and these diatoms are all over his clothes," I said, "he isn't washing off before he dresses."
What about Kim Luong's body?
Definitely not the same flora as the Sen, Posner said. But I did take a sample of water from the James River, close to where you live, as a matter of fact. Again, nearly the same frequency distribution.
Flora on her body and flora in the James, consistent with each other?
I had to make sure. One question I do have is whether diatoms from the James are going to be everywhere around here, Posner said.
Well, let's see, I said. I got Q-tips and swabbed my forearm, my hair, and the bottoms of my shoes, and Posner made more slides. There wasn't a single diatom.
In tap water, maybe? I asked.
Posner shook his head. So they shouldn't be all over a person, I wouldn't think, unless that person has been in the river, lake, ocean.
I paused as an odd thought came to me.
The Dead Sea. The Jordan River, I said.
What? Posner asked, baffled.
The spring at Lourdes, I said, getting more excited. The sacred river Ganges, all believed to be places of miracles where the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed could enter the water to be healed.
He's swimming in the James this time of year? Posner said. The guy must be nuts.
There's no cure for hypertrichosis, I said.
What the hell's that?
A horrible, extremely rare disorder. Hair all over your body when you're born. A baby fine hair that can get up to 6, 7, 9 inches long. Among other anomalies.
Eh.
Maybe he bathed nude in the Sen, hoping he might be miraculously healed. Maybe now he's doing the same thing in the James, I said.
Jesus,
Posner said. Now that's a creepy thought. When I returned to my office, Marina was sitting in a chair by my desk.
You look like you've been up all night, he said to me, slurping coffee.
Lucy ran off to New York. I talked to Joe and her parents.
Lucy did what?
She's on her way back. It's all right.
Well, she better mind her P's and Q's. This ain't a good time for her to be acting squirrely.
Marino, I quickly said. It's possible the killer bathes in rivers with some notion it might cure his disorder. I'm wondering if he's staying someplace near the James.
He thought about this for a minute, an odd expression spreading over his face. Running footsteps sounded in the hall. Let's hope there ain't some old estate along there where the owner ain't been heard from for a while, Marino said. I have a bad feeling.
Then Fielding was in my office yelling at Marino.
What the hell's wrong with you?
Veins and arteries were bulging in Fielding's neck, his face bright red. I'd never heard him raise his voice to anyone.
You let the fucking press find out before we can even get to the goddamn scene, he accused.
Hey, Marino said.
Calm down. Let the fucking press know what?
Diane Bray's been murdered, Fielding said. It's all over the news.